time to use our resources and strengthen the infrastructure such as accommodation to boost our tourism industry.
The Economic Cooperation Organization, or shortly ECCO, is an Asian political and economic intergovernmental entity with 10 member states, including Iran, Turkey, and Pakistan. Sari was selected as the tourism capital of ECCO during the third ECCO ministerial meeting on tourism, held in October 2019 in Tajikistan. The Tajik capital, Dushanbe, was earlier named the tourism capital of ECCO for the year 2021. And Iran's northwestern city of Ardabil will succeed Sari as the 2023 capital of the ECCO region. Officials say the initiative opens up new opportunities for investment in the designated city, which will help boost the tourism infrastructure.
I can say that many countries in ECCO region are taking steps towards the facilitation of the issuing visas for the citizens of ECCO member states. And so, of course, the facilitation or removing the visas, is important factor in increasing the number of touristic arrivals. Could contribute in the development of touristic sector in ECCO region.
From the Caspian Hyrcanian mixed forests to marshlands, wildlife refuge, and an amazing beach, the mesmerizing and diverse nature of Sari indeed deserves to be titled the tourism capital of ECCO. The organization says it will continue the initiative and will name new cities as tourism capitals each year to boost cooperation between tourism entities of the member states.
With its eye-catching landscapes and mesmerizing nature, Sari has already been a tourist magnet for mainly Iranian travelers. And now with its designation as the tourism capital of the ECCO region, the city should expect a larger number of foreign tourists to visit the city and enjoy its attractions. Yusuf Jalali, Sari.
On Wednesday morning, Palestinians woke up to the tragic news of the brutal killing of Al Jazeera journalist Shirin Abu Akleh in the Jenin refugee camp. Abu Akleh was killed after being shot in the head while covering Israeli army raids in the northern occupied West Bank. Her killing drew angry reactions and condemnations in Palestine and around the world. Palestinian resistance groups, including Hamas and the Islamic Jihad, condemned in the strongest terms Israel's killing of the Palestinian journalist.
The Zionist enemy killed Shireen in cold blood in another example of their brutality against Palestinians. Killing her exposes the violent and criminal nature of the Zionist regime. We condemn this brutal crime and we demand that the Zionist regime and its leaders be brought to justice for their crimes.
Shirin Abu Akleh's extrajudicial killing is further evidence of a trend by Israeli regime forces to systematically attack journalists. During the 11-day war in 2021, Israeli warplanes bombed several buildings in Gaza, housing media companies and news channels.
The Zionist regime attacks journalists in order to silence them and to hide the truth. By targeting Palestinian journalists, the Zionist regime wants to terrorize us and stop us from exposing its war crimes to the world. The Zionist regime doesn't want us to show its ugly face.
Statistics show that Israeli regime forces have killed some 50 Palestinian journalists during the last 22 years. During the Great March of Return, Israeli snipers shot and killed two Gazan journalists and injured dozens more.
This is not the first time Israeli armed forces has targeted Palestinian journalists. They have targeted a number of them during the Great March of Return in 2018. And this is also another addition to Israeli illegal practices against Palestinian journalists by killing Shirin Abu Akleh, one of the most famous journalists in the Palestinian territories. Israel is trying to kill the truth.
Experts say Israeli forces will continue with their violations against journalists as long as the international community keeps turning a blind eye. Israeli forces have been increasingly attacking journalists in recent years. Palestinian journalists risk their lives on a daily basis to cover the news and expose the brutality of the Israeli regime. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
With every candle symbolizing the path she lit, activists and journalists gathered in front of the Embassy of Palestine in Tehran, not just to condemn her killing by an Israeli sniper, but to show the world that Shirin Abu Akleh's footsteps will be followed. Al Jazeera's 51-year-old journalist was targeted on assignment while wearing a press jacket that made it easy for her to be identified as a journalist.
The policies of our Zionist enemies has always been clear. They are against anyone who unveils the reality on the ground. The killing of a well-known journalist like Shirin shows that they obviously don't want the world to know the truth about Palestine.
We lost a dear colleague who was killed on assignment. This is a sad day for journalists all over the world. What makes it even more tragic is that she was not even in a war zone. This proves that freedom of speech and human rights means nothing to the Zionist regime.
The Palestinian journalist was also a citizen of the United States, and many are now asking why the U.S. is silent about what they can only describe as blatant murder. Shirin was a veteran journalist and very well known, too. Obviously, the Israeli regime does not want the world to know about its crimes, and that's why they silenced her.
Well, this shows the cruelty of the Israeli regime. As you can see, if we see such an act in other countries, we may face with a strong reaction by the Western governments and also Western media. But today, inside occupied Palestine, we have seen one of the most cruel scenes that could be possible. An Israeli soldier attacked a journalist and killed him in front of the camera. And this shows that, unfortunately, by the double standards of the Western governments and also Western medias, Israeli governments can continue to kill and assassinate everyone. And this is completely against the freedom of speech and the freedom of the Palestinian people.
Shirin Abu Akleh was covering the Israeli forces raid on the Jenin refugee camp in the occupied West Bank on Wednesday. The veteran television correspondent was a household name across the Arab world for her bold coverage of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
The tragic event has sparked outrage in Iran as well as other parts of the world. Those who have gathered in front of the Palestinian embassy in Tehran are calling for impunity for Israel to end. Gisumisha Ahmadi, Tehran.
Following the killing of Palestinian journalist Shirin Abu Akleh, Yemeni journalists have gathered in front of the Palestinian embassy in Sana'a to denounce Israeli crimes against Palestinian journalists and media activists.
The Yemeni Journalists Union condemns what has happened to Shirin Abu Akleh and her colleague. They were directly targeted by Israeli forces while wearing a press vest to ensure protection in the areas of conflict based on international conventions. Her killing is a flagrant violation of international law. We call on all media activists around the world to express solidarity with Abu Akleh and other colleagues in Palestine.
The Yemeni media activists denounced in the strongest terms the targeted killing of Abu Akleh by Israeli forces as she was covering an Israeli raid in the occupied West Bank.
The news of the martyrdom of Shirin was shocking. And the whole world is shocked because she was a powerful and influential figure and was able to represent a strong voice. The killing of Shirin is a turning point and the beginning of a new phase, and her blood will have a significant impact, God willing, in pushing the free people to move against the Zionist project.
Abu Akleh was a veteran Palestinian journalist for the Qatar-based Al Jazeera television news network. She was hit by a live bullet while covering an Israeli raid in the city of Jenin while wearing a press vest.
Yemeni journalists say Shirin Abu Akleh will always remain a symbol of courage for all the free journalists around the world who stand against oppression, whatever it takes. They say Abu Akleh's killing is a blatant violation of international law on the protection of journalists. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Some say the recent election changes everything. Others say it doesn't. But it has changed a century of unionist political dominance.
This state was founded on the basis of a gerrymandered sectarian headcount, where it was believed there would be a permanent and perpetual unionist majority. Nationalists and Republicans were never intended or expected to get the top political job here.
The election has complicated Northern Ireland's existing problems. Sinn Féin nationalists' victory, a step towards a future United Ireland, a blow to the Unionists, with the Democratic Unionists Party threatening to boycott the Stormont Assembly over a post-Brexit sea border for trade that they say undermines Northern Ireland's position in the United Kingdom.
Among the things that remain to be changed, this reminder of the decades-old sectarian divide, a wall separating communities as it has done through decades of troubles and peace. We tried to speak to people on the Unionist side of it to no avail. But real change seems happening in the center. The Alliance Party has doubled its vote share among those who want to increase awareness. Cross-community efforts like those here may speak of a younger generation's desire to understand each other, regardless of which side they're on. And this is not the only center forging such ties, and they're all moving in the same direction.
So the purpose of this is trying to normalize interactions between both communities, to show young people that the culture and identity of those people based on the other side of the wall is no threat to their own culture and identity. And then a copper fastens their sense of culture, identity and space that makes it harder to feel threatened by others.
But while those threats remain, it is clear that there is a middle ground growing, thanks to these nascent cross-community ties. Saeed Puriza, Belfast, Northern Ireland.
Many believe the crime of sexually abusing a child is even more heinous than murder. The EU's executive arm, the European Commission, says 85 million child sex abuse videos and images were identified by the bloc's authorities last year, a record number.
In the EU, the reports related to the European Union, the member states, have increased with 6,000% the last 10 years. Why is this increasing? Of course, nobody knows for sure.
The Commission says it's not known exactly why these crimes are on the rise, but analysts say the EU has been allowed to expand too quickly, with some nations harbouring criminal gangs.
And now, of course, thanks to or due to open borders, are these criminal networks, they started to flourish and integrate further.
The EU Commission is proposing to establish a new agency designed to prevent child sex abuse and support victims.
At least one in five children falls victim to sexual violence during childhood in Europe. So these numbers are really embarrassing.
Anti-trafficking agencies say 2 million children recently entered the EU having fled the conflict in Ukraine, many of them unaccompanied. Gangs and individuals see an opportunity for exploitation.
The police and child protection services need to work together, plus they need to work together across borders, and there need to be better information sharing platforms.
The European Commission has a message for predators.
We are coming for you.
But critics are asking why more has not been done up to now. Given that it promotes itself as a project designed to protect and improve the lives of citizens, rights groups say this issue seriously undermines the credibility of the European Union. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com /EN.
In the limelight.
New COVID-19 infections are once again on the rise across the United States, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC. Please stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Marjorie Kahn, journalist. This article is published under the heading Trump judges anti-mask ruling continues to imperil travelers as COVID rises across the United States. Here's the story. New COVID-19 infections are once again on the rise across the United States of America, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC. COVID deaths in the U.S. have now reached the 1 million mark, a figure widely regarded as an undercount. The steady increase in COVID-19 cases underscores the perilous wrong-headedness of the recent decision by Catherine Kimball Mizell, the federal district court judge in Florida, who struck down the national transportation mask mandate on April 18th. The majority opinion is a result searching in vain for a plausible reason, California Supreme Court Justice Alan Broussard wrote in 1988, dissenting from a poorly reasoned majority decision in People v. Guerrero that broadened the factors a judge could consider when imposing a sentencing enhancement. Broussard's statement also aptly describes the recent decision by Mizell, who likewise reasoned backward by amassing reasons for her preordained result. As of April 17th, the day before Mizell's decision, new COVID infections were averaging over 37,000 cases daily, up 39% from 2 weeks prior, according to a New York Times database. Nevertheless, Mizell's ruling allows individual airlines and transit agencies to decide for themselves whether to require masks. By the end of the day, on April 18th, the country's largest airlines and the Amtrak rail system had shelved their mask mandates. Some pilots announced mid-flights that people could remove their masks, much to the shock of many immunocompromised people and those traveling with unvaccinated young children. The lawsuit in which Mizell ruled was filed in July 2021 against the Biden administration by two individuals and the anti-COVID regulation organization Health Freedom Defend Fund. The two individuals claimed they suffered from anxiety and panic attacks caused by wearing masks. In voiding the mandate, Mizell set forth a bizarre interpretation of authority Congress granted the CDC to promulgate rules to prevent the spread of communicable diseases, writing that the mask mandate exceeds the CDC's statutory authority. In her 59-page ruling, Mizell held that the CDC overreached the bounds of its authority under the Public Health Services Act of 1944 when it imposed the transportation mask mandate. A Trump appointee and former clerk to Clarence Thomas, Mizell was rated not qualified by the American Bar Association before she was confirmed by Republican senators in a November 2020 party line vote. Her lack of qualification is clear, judging by her misinterpretation of Public Health Services Act. The act empowers the CDC to make and enforce such regulations as in its judgment are necessary to prevent the introduction, transmission, or spread of communicable diseases from foreign countries into states or from one state into any other state. The statute lists examples of this authority, stating that the CDC may provide for such inspection, disinfection, sanitation, pest extermination, destruction of animals or articles found to be so infected, and other measures as in its judgment may be necessary. Requiring masks is a sanitation measure, the Biden administration argued, because it keeps the air cleaner. But Mizell consulted dictionaries and word usage in 1940s to conclude that sanitation requires active cleaning and masks clean nothing. Although Mizell quoted the CDC's finding that masks are one of the most effective strategies available for reducing COVID-19 transmission, she substituted her own construction of the act for the CDC's. Mizell refused to defer to the CDC as required by the Chevron deference doctrine, which requires a court to accept an agency's interpretation of a statute when the statute is ambiguous and the agency's interpretation is reasonable. Instead, Mizell relied on the major questions doctrine, which holds that agencies such as the CDC cannot decide questions of vast economic or political significance unless Congress specifically authorizes it. Right-wing judges often use this flawed doctrine to limit the power of the government to protect people's rights. Mizell concluded that the mask mandate violated the Administrative Procedures Act, APA, which requires granting the public advance notice and the opportunity to comment before an agency promulgates a rule. She rejected the good cause exception to the notice and comment requirement in spite of the COVID emergency. Mizell dismissed as insufficient the CDC's claim that the mask mandate is in the public interest, which is one of the factors included in the APA's definition of good cause. She wrote that the only reason cited by the CDC for the mask mandate is the public health emergency caused by COVID-19. Astoundingly, Mizell noted the court accepts the CDC's policy determination that requiring masks will limit COVID-19 transmission and will thus decrease the serious illnesses and death that COVID-19 occasions. But she then concluded that this doesn't amount to good cause, stressing that the mandate would constrain the public choices and actions. Mizell chose the freedom of travelers like plaintiff Anna Daza, who have anxiety aggravated by wearing a mask over the COVID public health emergency. On April 20th, the CDC issued a statement asking the DOJ to appeal Mizell's ruling. It is CDC's continuing assessment that, at this time, an order requiring masking in the indoor transportation corridor remains necessary for the public health, the agency wrote. CDC continues to recommend that people wear masks in all indoor public transportation settings. When people wear a well-fitting mask or respirator over their nose and mouth in indoor travel or public transportation settings, they protect themselves and those around them, including those who are immunocompromised or not yet vaccine eligible, and help keep travel and public transportation safer for everyone. Accordingly, on April 20th, the DOJ filed a notice of appeal of Mizell's ruling. Inexplicably, the DOJ did not request a temporary pause on Mizell's sweeping decision pending appeal. The conservative U.S. Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit will hear the appeal, which could take several months. Ultimately, the case could end up at the Supreme Court. The outcome could have long-lasting significance. A federal district court ruling does not constitute binding precedent, but a Court of Appeals ruling and, of course, a Supreme Court ruling would. This sets up a clash between public health and a conservative judiciary. And what's riding on it is the future ability of our nation's public health agencies to protect the American public. Lawrence Augustin, a public health law expert at Georgetown University, told the New York Times, adding, "The risk is that you will get a conservative 11th Circuit ruling that will so curtail CDC's powers to fight COVID and future pandemics that it will make all Americans less safe and secure." Augustin also said, "If CDC can't impose an uninstructive requirement to wear a mask to prevent a virus from going state to state, then it literally has no power to do anything." On May 3rd, the day the most recent extension of the mask mandate expired, the CDC issued a new recommendation that all individuals 2 years and older wear masks in indoor areas of public transportation, such as airplanes, trains, etc. The transportation hubs, such as airports, stations, etc., the CDC recommended that people wear masks in crowded or poorly ventilated locations such as airport jetways. But because one right-wing federal judge issued a nationwide injunction against the transportation mask mandate, the CDC could only recommend wearing masks to protect the American people against COVID, as opposed to requiring it.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story. In
what is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello, welcome to The Debate. I'm Kaveh Tahlai. Nakba Day is marked by Palestinians in the world every year on May 15th. The anniversary of the day Israel was created and landed in Palestine, taking away land from Palestinians and expelling hundreds of thousands of Palestinians from their land. In this edition of the program, we will look at the significance of Nakba Day this year, why it is happening at a special time, and whether Israel, labeled an apartheid regime, is fast-moving in not being recognized in the international arena due to its continuous violations. First, let me introduce our guests for this edition of The Spotlight. Director of the Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought, Zafar Bangash, joins us from Toronto. We also have human rights activist and member of Manchester Palestine Action, Aidy Mormick, who joins us from Manchester.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
I'd like to welcome you both. And if I may first start with Yusuf Arbangash, taking a look at what this day Nakba is. Can you give us a quick background check, or should I say history check, as to why it's called Nakba and what your thoughts are on that in terms of a historical perspective?
Well, Nakba means catastrophe, and this is an expression that the Palestinians have given to what happened to them in May of 1948, when Zionist marauding gangs attacked more than 400 Palestinian villages and towns in Palestine, and not only ethnically cleansed hundreds of thousands of Palestinians, something like 750,000 to a million Palestinians, but also murdered a number of them. We are all familiar with Deir Yassin, where these war criminals like Ariel Sharon, Yitzhak Rabin, Yitzhak Shamir, Menachem Begin, these war criminals were all involved in perpetrating horrible crimes against the Palestinian people. And literally, of course, those 750 to a million Palestinians that were expelled, they have now, of course, now increased to something like 5-6 million, many of them in Jordan, in Lebanon, in Syria, and other countries around the world. But the important point is that the Palestinians have not forgotten their tragedy, and every year they commemorate Nakba Day to make sure that their future generations continue to remember that their land has been stolen from them, that alien invaders from Europe and North America invaded their land and have illegally settled on that land, and they unfortunately continue to do so even today. But the circumstances are changing, because we see that the manner in which the Zionists continue their brutality, the Palestinians have not given up. They have not become cowed down. So the important point to keep in mind is that while the Palestinians commemorate their Nakba Day, the Zionists have already lost the battle, because the one factor that they wanted to impose on the Palestinians, that is to terrorize them, to instill fear in them, the Palestinians have not been terrorized. They have not been submitted out of fear. And so the fact that they are willing to resist their occupiers already means that the Palestinians have won. And I believe that the day is not far away when this Zionist alien entity would be removed from occupied Palestine.
Okay, Eddie Murbeck, you as an human rights activist and also a member, as I'm reading here, of Manchester Palestine Action, you have a direct account and experience with what Palestinians have gone through in terms of their suffering. And perhaps you can tell us about that, in particular, your experiences in the Gaza Strip, and then tell us your perspective as to the way the Palestinians have suffered. Okay, we're having some connection problems with you. Let me go to Yusuf Arbangash. So when you take a look at this particular Nakba, of which you said that, Israel is losing legitimacy. Perhaps, at least based on recent memory, there haven't been so many incidents that have happened consecutively in a row that have catapulted the plight of Palestinians across the minds of people around the world. Because we had the month of Ramadan, we had what happened with the violation at the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and then in turn the heavy-handed tactics that Israelis used against the Palestinians. You had the couple instances where you had Palestinians that came out and showed their anger. Unfortunately, some lives, Israeli lives, were lost. And then you had what happened with this reporter who was assassinated in the form and manner that she did. And also you had the Al-Quds rallies. 2 years with the COVID lockdown, people had a chance finally to come out and show their support for Palestinians. All of these put together, do you think that there's a new momentum that is now present, that maybe it's time for this to be taken to another level?
Oh, absolutely. What you have outlined is exactly the situation as we find today. And in fact, the fact that the Palestinians have not given up hope, the fact that they have not given up their struggle. And, you know, you mentioned that, Shirin Abu Akleh was martyred, assassinated, outside Jenin refugee camp. Now, Jenin is a hotbed of resistance in Palestine. In fact, there are a number of other areas as well, but Jenin in particular, and it has a very long history. In fact, it was the 20th anniversary of their uprising when the 20 years ago, the Zionists perpetrated brutal massacres in Jenin, and yet the people of Jenin have not surrendered. They have not been cowed down. I also want to point out the fact that over the last few months, there have been a number of reports published by international human rights organizations that includes Amnesty International, that includes Human Rights Watch, that includes even the UN Human Rights Council that have published reports. And in fact, only last month, Professor Michael Link, who was the special rapporteur for Palestine, UN rapporteur for Palestine, who's a Canadian professor, they published reports, all of them, including incidentally B'Tselem, which is an Israeli human rights organization. They have all pointed out that Israel is an apartheid regime. And this thing itself, this designation itself, is now gaining ground worldwide. And we also see that the fact that the Palestinians are standing up, rising up, they're not giving up their rights, they are determined to resist their occupiers, clearly indicates that there is now a new level of resistance that has emerged among the Palestinians. And so the Zionists themselves are terrified. A few days ago, the former Israeli prime minister, and he also used to be the Israeli army chief, Ehud Barak, actually issued a statement. It is incredible that he said that, "I'm not so sure that Israel would be able to celebrate its 80th anniversary of independence." Now, that's an incredible statement to make, coming from a figure as high up as a former prime minister and a former army chief, which indicates that there is a new reality,
sure,
a ground reality.
Hold on to that thought, because I have the statement that he said, Zafar Bangash, and I'd like to elaborate on that statement with you, since you brought it up. But since we have Eddie Mormick, welcome back. My question to you is the direct experience that you have had firsthand, seeing the Palestinians and how they suffer. Perhaps you can elaborate on that for us and describe to us what you saw and what you experienced. And I'm talking in particular in the Gaza Strip.
Yeah, I mean, I was in Gaza for 2 years, and I was a teacher in the university there, the Al-Aqsa University. Two of my students were killed. One of them, her entire family were killed. Her two little babies, her mother and her father-in-law and husband, all killed with one bomb. I taught a family that lost 29 members of their extended family in 3 days, the Samouni family, during the bombing of 2008-09. And I taught them a year later when they were still living in the chicken coop just by their house that had been obliterated, as had all their houses, as had so many of their family members. When you knock on a door in Gaza and you ask where they're from, they will tell you a place that doesn't exist anymore. They'll tell you Mejdel or Bejerja or Barbara or many of the villages that no longer exist because of the Nakba. They are continuously living in Gaza, which is the largest refugee camp in the world, 1.2 million people in one of the most crowded places on the planet. And they are surrounded by Israeli jets in the sky. If you go in Gaza, you have F-16s in the sky and drones regularly bombing and surveilling the country. You have the gunships on the horizon in the sea, which is actually destroying the fishing industry. The kids who go and look out to the horizon on the sea might have dreams and hopes, and yet they see Israeli gunships controlling the sea borders. And then on the land borders, if you go there, you see the snipers and the tanks and the jeeps lining along the frontier with Israel there in Gaza. And that is the land area where people are regularly shot merely for going to school or farming in the most arable land, which they can no longer do because of the level of atrocities that are inflicted at the border, not to mention the regular bombings. And I was there during the bombing of Gaza, and we saw kids after children and many parents coming in to the intensive care unit, being rolled around with dust coming off them. And this is the sharp edge of Israeli brutality. And what's more, this is the ongoing Nakba, because these people are victims of the 1948 Nakba. Most of them are refugees, United Nations registered refugees. And you're seeing it now. This is not finished. The most recent announcement, the decision by the Israeli court that Masaf Atta, which is eight hamlets, communities just south of Nablus in the West Bank, that's going to be ethnically cleansed. The ethnic cleansing continues. So whereas Gaza has been made into this horrific medieval siege and a completely blockaded territory of a population that is mostly children, right now you're seeing across the rest of Palestine some utterly horrific shows of brutality. And what I would say is, for me in Gaza, and for Palestinians, and for those that have been well acquainted with the Palestinian issue, we are not surprised, sadly, by the level of brutality. We are not surprised. But instead, we are seeing so many people around the world shocked by what's seen on the funeral of Shireen Abu Akleh, and when people are being pushed around and beaten with batons, and you're getting Gary Lineker and Piers Morgan, famous people in England, sharing it. 11 million people seeing that brutality. For us, we've seen it again and again and again. You're seeing Palestinians right now being forced out of another house in Hebron. And yet, right now, people around the world are seeing full on the level of Israeli brutality that is inflicted on so many Palestinians. And that is the ongoing Nakba. But what I would say is, as the other gentleman said, people are waking up. There is no question. When you get famous people sharing it and 11 million seeing that horrific episode with the funeral of Shireen Abu Akleh, you are seeing a massive change. And there is a youth movement in England. We're talking about what Israel said. They said that the young ones will forget, the old will die and the young ones will forget. Well, believe me, the youth in Manchester here, we have a big Nakba demonstration tomorrow. And it's the youth leading it. So they are not forgetting. They will carry on. And the world is changing right now. And they are changing every year. Just like May last year with the mass murder of 250 Palestinians, 67 kids in 10 days. This May, you have the Nakba again. And you have a journalist being killed in cold blood. And media is finally having to report it. People are waking up. And this is another sea change. Things are changing rapidly. You're seeing it with the Amnesty report. You're seeing it, as you say, with even Israeli ex-generals speaking out against what's happening. This is real. And finally, right, we might see an ex-apartheid Israel, the system of horrific oppression against the Palestinians, just like we have seen the end of apartheid in South Africa. And I don't think it's that far away. The world is changing. People are waking up now.
Zafar Bangash, so you hear A.D. Mormick there, and I'm not too sure the energy that he that comes out of him, that exudes, that brings out what the truth, unfortunate truth, is. And it's very inspiring. Listen to what he is saying, and he's not that old, and so we're seeing this type of knowledge that has been transferred into action. In his case, to have gone into Gaza and to have taught there. And obviously, the word is being spread around. It's very promising, but at the same time, when you take a look at the track record, things are not moving in favor of Palestinians. So there needs to be a tidal wave to take over that. What can be done to build again on the momentum that I talked about a little bit earlier?
Well, first of all, I think I must compliment your other guest for his solidarity with the Palestinian people and spending 2 years in Gaza, which is, as you said, is an open-air prison. And this is to his great credit, and this shows his humanity and compassion in support of the legitimate rights of the Palestinian people. With respect to the struggle of the Palestinian people and the momentum, I think we need to understand that more and more people worldwide are now waking up to the reality of the absolute brutality of the Zionists. And people are no longer willing to buy into this Zionist propaganda that it's a besieged state, that it is a beleaguered state, etc. What is also important to keep in mind is that Zionist crimes are basically underwritten by the United States of America. And the United States itself is now going through into a tailspin. It is losing grip. It is losing wars. In fact, since the Second World War, the United States has not won a single war that it has been engaged in. Last year, it was driven out of Afghanistan. It's not got its way in many other parts of the world. So what we are beginning to see is, and now we also see that the U.S. is grappling with Russia. It's in fact waging a proxy war in Ukraine. But it's not getting its way. And there are countries that are rising up that are challenging U.S. Imperialist designs. And if the U.S. is brought to its knees, and I think that day is also not far because its mainstay is the U.S. dollar. And I think there are indications that when more than 50% of the countries of the world do not use the US dollar, that would be the end of the US itself. So if the US economy collapses, which is an underwriter of the Zionist crimes, then obviously the Zionist regime would wither away. And of course, internally also, there are a lot of fissures in the Israeli society. You know, last year when the Zionists were bombarding the Gaza Strip for 11 days, and when the Israeli rulers asked to enter or send ground forces into Gaza, the military commanders refused. They said that we cannot do it because we cannot fight on multiple fronts. What they were referring to was that not only was it the people of Gaza, but people in the West Bank and also the Green Line, which is 1948 Palestine,
right.
The people were rising up and their military commander said that this situation we cannot control. And so now we see that within the Palestinian community, the Palestinians under occupation are in fact getting united, rising up, and they are confronting the Zionist bullets and guns and tanks with their bare hands and with stones. That, I think, is a very, very hopeful sign, and that definitely would lead to the elimination of this monstrous Zionist ideology and the liberation of Palestine.
Sure. I'd like to ask from you, Eddie Mormick, if I can test your memory here and go back to when you had the March of Return protests that were taking place, which wasn't too long ago. And basically, one of the things that stood out there was the way that Israel was targeting the protesters. And amongst them were journalists that were killed. Amongst them, there were, medics that were targeted. And, of course, you had children that were killed, and you had many who were wounded. Many people think that Israel was doing that in its self-defense. But perhaps you can open that up for us and paint the reality of what was going on there and what that meant. At least that's one of the things that stands out when it comes to the plight of Palestinians and the resistance.
At some point, there will be proper investigations into all of these deaths. When, during the Great Return March, you remember Yasser Mataja, who was a journalist, who I actually met quite a lot in Gaza, who was killed with his press top on then. That was 2018, the same time as also Razan Al-Najjar, the medic, full medical clothing, who'd gone to attend some of those injured merely for protesting. When I was there in Gaza, we were marching free to march at the border areas where hundreds were there, and they were marching with their flags, marching towards the borders, and you had jeeps picking them off one by one. Ahmed Deeb, a 20-year-old, was killed right next to me, merely for marching. And I was saying to them, well, you're going to get shot if you get any closer. And he said, I'd rather die standing than die in my beds, because that's the choice young 20-year-old guys have in Gaza. And in terms of investigations, well, guess what? Yasser Mataja and Razan Al-Najjar, young people with futures who were skilled at their jobs, medics and journalists, were wiped out without trace, without investigation. Imagine if it was people who were in right now, Ukrainians who were getting bombed, and if they were being shot, medics and journalists, where would it be? It would be all over the news. It would be all over the world. We can't have double standards. Palestinians should have the same rights as anybody else. Palestinian parents grieve the same as anybody else. They have been living this for 74 years. And so, just like the Goldstone report was about the family that I taught, the Samouni family, 29 members of their extended family murdered. And that was mostly children. And that was in 3 days, for goodness sake. And yet the Goldstone report said that these were probable war crimes, and nothing. There was no accountability. Finally, we are getting International Criminal Court changes. Finally, the United Nations is saying a little bit more. Even finally, some Western governments are starting to speak up a little bit, including, of course, the United Nations saying that some goods would be sanctioned as a big list. So it's all incremental. It will only lead to one place eventually, and that is that any apartheid regime, any regime that is purposefully and set out to oppress not only a large bunch of the local people, but the original indigenous population of Palestinians who have been there for thousands of years. And so finally, there will be comeuppance, just as there was for South Africa when there were massive investigations afterwards. And all of these crimes that we're seeing now will actually get some proper scrutiny and some proper investigation, because right now we're still miles off. Israel gets a green light. In fact, worse than that, Israel gets £38 billion of over 10 years of aid from America, including mostly weapons grants. Britain is still dealing with Elbit Systems, which is the largest Israeli weapons company, developing their weapons by bombing Palestinians in Gaza and, you know, announcing it and selling those weapons as such. Fortunately, the world is changing. Fortunately, Palestinians still resist on the ground. In England, we have so many actions against the weapons factories now that have shut them down, including the one near here in Oldham. We've had HSBC divest from Elbit Systems because of the cluster bombs. We're going to have, I think, Puma soon will stop sponsoring the Israeli Football Association. And we've had loads of universities divest, like Manchester University from Caterpillar and other companies that are complicit. Sure. So there is ongoing changes internationally, and it will happen. And the people will hold Israel to account where governments and legal systems haven't. But eventually, just like South Africa, when the people acted like they are doing now in this growth, eventually the legal scrutiny will grow, and so will governments and institutions internationally, and that will hold Israel to account. It is a process. It is only going one way. Israel is out of control. They're not even caring anymore about what the world sees anymore. And finally, I think we will see freedom for Palestine in my lifetime, which is something I never thought I'd see. And eventually, apartheid, just like South Africa, will no longer be allowed to happen. And people all over that area will have the same rights as each other, which is hardly utopia. It's something that everybody should be expecting.
I was going to ask you about what you said, Zafar Bangash, and I think it's the right time, about the ex-premier Ehud Barak, who said Israel could cease to exist before the 80th anniversary, and what he said, that Jews have not ruled for more than 80 years on the trot throughout history, predicting a doom and gloom scenario once he said that. Where he said the present Israeli regime represents the third experience and is approaching the eighth decade of the entity's existence. Do you agree with him? If you could say that in 30 seconds.
I think all of the indications are, both internally as well as externally, that the Zionist ideology is heading for destruction. And this is because of their own arrogance, because the Palestinian people, in their absolute magnanimity, they have not said that they don't want to live with the Jewish people. In fact, they have not persecuted the Jewish people in their entire history. Whenever the Jewish people were persecuted elsewhere, they sought refuge either in Palestine or any other Muslim countries. And Muslims are proud of that fact and that history.
Okay.
But when you have this Zionist occupiers with this Zionist ideology of racism, of ethnic cleansing, coming into Palestine, and they want everything for themselves, then I think they are digging their own grave.
Very well.
I believe that they are.
Thank you for that. Sorry, we're fresh out of time. Zafar Bangash there, director of the Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought. And it was great seeing you again. A.D. Mormick from Manchester. Hopefully tomorrow we can connect with you if you're going on the protest that you said you are for Nakba Day. Human rights activist and member of the Manchester Palestine Action. Thank you.